He stopped and felt the dirt under his feet. He was barefoot as usual. When he was a student on Roque, he had worn shoes. But he had come back home, to Gaunt, to Realbi, with his wizard staff, and kicked his shoes off. He stood still and felt the dust and rock of the clifftop path under his feet, and the cliff under that, and the roots of the island in the dark under that. In the dark, under the waters, all islands touched and were one. So his teacher, Ard, had said, and so his teachers on Roque had said. But this was his island, his rock, dust, dirt. His wizardry grew out of it. "My mastery is here," the boy had said, but it went deeper than mastery. That, perhaps, was something Dulce could teach him. What went deeper than mastery? What he'd learned here on Gaunt before he ever went to Roque. And the boy must have a staff. Why had Nimerly let him leave Roque without one, empty-handed as apprentice or a witch? Power like that shouldn't go wandering about unchanneled and unsignaled. "My teacher had no staff," Dulce thought, and at the same moment thought, "He wants his staff from me. Gauntish oak, from the hands of a gauntish wizard. Well, if he earns it, I'll make him one. If he can keep his mouth closed. And I'll leave him my lore books. If he can clean out a hen house, and understand the glosses of Danemere, and keep his mouth closed." The new student cleaned out the hen house and hoed the bean patch, learned the meaning of the glosses of Danemere and the arcana of the Enlides, and kept his mouth closed. He listened. He heard what Dulce said. Sometimes he heard what Dulce thought. He did what Dulce wanted, and what Dulce didn't know he wanted. His gift was far beyond Dulce's guidance. Yet he had been right to come to Realbi, and they both knew it. Dulce thought sometimes in those years about sons and fathers. He had quarreled with his own father, a sorcerer prospector, over his choice of a teacher. His father had shouted that a student of Ard's was no son of his, had nursed his rage and died unforgiving. Dulce had seen young men weep for joy at the birth of a first son. He'd seen poor men pay witches a year's earnings for the promise of a healthy boy, and a rich man touch his gold-bedizened baby's face and whisper, adoring, "My immortality." He had seen men beat their sons, bully and humiliate them, spite and thwart them, hating the death they saw in them. He'd seen the answering hatred in the son's eyes, the threat, the pitiless contempt. And seeing it, Dulce knew why he had never sought reconciliation with his father. He had seen a father and son work together from daybreak to sundown, the old man guiding a blind ox, the middle-aged man driving the iron-bladed plow, never a word spoken. As they started home, the old man laid his hand a moment on the son's shoulder. In that touch, Dulce had seen what was lacking in his life. He remembered it when he looked across the hearth winter evenings at the dark face bent above a lore book, or a shirt that needed mending. The eyes cast down, the mouth closed, the spirit listening. Once in his lifetime, if he's lucky, a wizard finds somebody he can talk to. Nimerly had said that to Dulce a night or two before he left Roque, a year or two before Nimerly was chosen archmage. He had been the master patterner and the kindest of all Dulce's teachers at the school. "I think if you stayed, Enhemon, we could talk." Dulce had been unable to answer at all for a while, then stammering, guilty at his ingratitude and incredulous at his obstinacy, "Master, I would stay, but my work is on Gaunt. I wish it was here with you. It's a rare gift to know where you need to be before you've been to all the places you don't need to be. Well, send me a student now and then. Roque needs gauntish wizardry. I think we're leaving things out here, things worth knowing." Dulce had sent students on to the school, three or four of them, nice lads, with a gift for this or that. But the one Nimerly waited for had come and gone of his own will, and what they thought of him on Roque, Dulce didn't know. Silence didn't say. He had learned there in 2 or 3 years what some boys learned in 6 or 7, and many never learned at all. But to him it had been mere groundwork. "Why didn't you come to me first?" Dulce had demanded, "and then Roke, to put a polish on it." "I didn't want to waste your time." "Did Nemmerly know you were coming to work with me?" Silence shook his head. "If you'd deigned to tell him your intentions, he might have sent a message to me." Silence looked stricken. "Was he your friend?" Dulce paused. "He was my master. Would have been my friend, perhaps, if I'd stayed on Rogue. Have wizards friends? No more than they have wives or sons, some would say. Once he said to me that in our trade it's a lucky man who finds someone to talk to. Keep that in mind. If you're lucky, one day you'll have to open your mouth." Silence bowed his rough, thoughtful head. "If it hasn't rusted shut," Dulce added. "If you ask me to talk, I'll talk," the young man said, so earnest, so willing to deny his whole nature at Dulce's request, that the wizard had to laugh. "I asked you not to," he said. "It's not my need I spoke of. I talk enough for two. Never mind. You'll know what to say when the time comes. That's the art, eh? What to say, when to say it. And the rest is silence." The young man slept on a pallet under the little west window of Dulce's house for 3 years. He learned wizardry, fed the chickens, milked the cow. He suggested once that Dulce keep goats. He hadn't said anything for a week or so, a cold, wet week of autumn. He said, "You might keep some goats." Dulce had the big lore book open on the table. He had been trying to reweave one of the Akastan spells, much broken and made powerless by the emanations of Fundaur centuries ago. He had just begun to get a sense of the missing word that might fill one of the gaps. He almost had it, and... "You might keep some goats," Silence said. Dulce considered himself a wordy, impatient man with a short temper. The necessity of not swearing had been a burden to him in his youth. And for 30 years, the imbecility of apprentices, clients, cows, and chickens had tried him sorely. Apprentices and clients were afraid of his tongue, though cows and chickens paid no attention to his outbursts. He had never been angry at Silence before. There was a very long pause. "What for?" Silence apparently didn't notice the pause or the extreme softness of Dulce's voice. "Milk, cheese, roast kid, company," he said. "Have you ever kept goats?" Dulce asked in the same soft, polite voice. Silence shook his head. He was, in fact, a town boy, born in Gauntport. He had said nothing about himself, but Dulce had asked around a bit. The father, a longshoreman, had died in the big earthquake when Silence would have been 7 or 8. The mother was a cook at a waterfront inn. At 12, the boy had got into some kind of trouble, probably messing about with magic, and his mother had managed to apprentice him to Alassin, a respectable sorcerer in Valmouth. There the boy had picked up his true name, and some skill in carpentry and farm work, if not much else. And Alassin had had the generosity, after 3 years, to pay his passage to Roke. And that was all Dulce knew about him. "I dislike goat cheese," Dulce said. Silence nodded, acceptant as always. From time to time in the years since then, Dulce remembered how he hadn't lost his temper when Silence asked about keeping goats. And each time the memory gave him a quiet satisfaction, like that of finishing the last bite of a perfectly ripe pear. After spending the next several days trying to recapture the missing word, he had set Silence to studying the Akastan spells. Together, they had finally worked it out. A long toil. "Like plowing with a blind ox," Dulce said. Not long after that, he had given Silence the staff he had made for him, Gauntish Oak. And the Lord of Gauntport tried once again to get Dulce to come down to do what needed doing in Gauntport. And Dulce had sent Silence down instead, and there he had stayed. And Dulce was standing on his own doorstep, 3 eggs in his hand, and the rain running cold down his back. How long had he been standing here? Why was he standing here? He'd been thinking about mud, about the floor, about silence. Had he been out walking on the path above the Overfell? No, that was years ago, in the sunlight. It was raining. He had fed the chickens and come back to the house with 3 eggs. They were still warm in his hand, silky, brown, lukewarm eggs. And the sound of thunder was still in his mind. The vibration of thunder was in his bones, in his feet. Thunder? No. There had been a thunderclap a while ago. This was not thunder. He had had this queer feeling and had not recognized it back then, before the earthquake that had sunk a half mile of the coast at Essary and swamped the wharves at Gauntport. He stepped down from the doorstep onto the dirt so that he could feel the ground with the nerves of his soles, but the mud slimed and fouled any messages the dirt had for him. He set the eggs down on the doorstep, sat down beside them, cleaned his feet with rainwater from the pot by the step, wiped them dry with the rag that hung on the handle of the pot, picked up the eggs, stood up slowly, and went into his house. He gave a sharp look at his staff, which leaned in the corner behind the door. He put the eggs in the larder, ate an apple quickly because he was hungry, and took his staff. It was yew, bound at the foot with copper, worn to silk at the grip. Nemerly had given it to him. "Stand," he said to it in its language, and let go of it. It stood as if he had driven it into a socket. "To the root," he said impatiently in the language of the making. "To the root." He watched the staff that stood on the shining floor. In a little while he saw it quiver very slightly, a shiver, a tremble. "Oh, oh, oh," said the old wizard. "What should I do?" he said aloud after a while. The staff swayed, was still, shivered again. "Enough of that, my dear," Dulce said, laying his hand on it. "Come now. No wonder I kept thinking about silence. I should send for him, send to him. No. What did Ard say? Find the center. Find the center. That's the question to ask. That's what to do." As he muttered on to himself, routing out his heavy cloak, setting water to boil on the small fire he had lighted earlier, he wondered if he had always talked to himself, if he had talked all the time when silence lived with him. No, it had become a habit after silence left, he thought, with the bit of his mind that went on thinking the ordinary thoughts of life, while the rest of it made preparations for terror and destruction. He hard-boiled the 3 new eggs and 1 already in the larder, and put them into a pouch along with 4 apples and a bladder of resinated wine in case he had to stay out all night. He shrugged arthritically into his heavy cloak, took up his staff, told the fire to go out, and left. He no longer kept a cow. He stood looking into the poultry yard, considering. The fox had been visiting the orchard lately. But the birds would have to forage if he stayed away. They must take their chances like everyone else. He opened their gate a little. Though the rain was no more than a misty drizzle now, they stayed hunched up under the henhouse eaves, disconsolate. The king hadn't crowed once this morning. "Have you anything to tell me?" Dulce asked them. Brown Bucca, his favorite, shook herself and said her name a few times. The others said nothing. "Well, take care. I saw the fox on the full moon night," Dulce said, and went on his way. As he walked, he thought. He thought hard. He recalled. He recalled all he could of matters his teacher had spoken of once only and long ago. Strange matters. So strange he had never known if they were true wizardry or mere witchery, as they said on Rogue. Matters he certainly had never heard about on Rogue, nor did he ever speak about them there. Maybe fearing the masters would despise him for taking such things seriously. Maybe knowing they wouldn't understand them, because they were Gauntish matters, truth of Gaunt. Yet Ard's lore books, that had come down from the great mage Enas of Gaunt said nothing of them. They were all word of mouth. They were home matters. Go to the dark pond at the top of Semmery's cow pasture, his teacher had told him. You can read the mountain there. You need to find the center. See where to go in. Go in? The boy, Dulce, had whispered. Well, what could you do from outside? Dulce was silent for a long time and then said, how? Thus. And Ard's long arms had stretched out and upward in the invocation of what Dulce would know later was a great spell of transforming. Ard spoke the words of the spell awry, as teachers of wizardry must do lest the spell operate. Dulce knew the trick of hearing them aright and remembering them. At the end, he had repeated them in his mind in silence, sketching the strange, awkward gestures that were part of them. And all at once, his hand had stopped. But you can't undo this, he said aloud. Ard nodded. It is irrevocable. Dulce knew no transformation that was irrevocable, no spell that could not be unsaid, except the word of unbinding, which is spoken only once. But why? At need, Ard said. Dulce knew better than to ask for explanation. The need to speak such a spell could not come often. The chance of his ever having to use it was very slight. He let the terrible spell sink down in his mind and be hidden and layered over with a thousand useful or beautiful or enlightening majories and charms, all the lore and rules of Roke, all the wisdom of the books Ard had bequeathed him. Crude, monstrous, useless, it lay in the dark of his mind for 60 years, like the cornerstone of an earlier forgotten house down in the cellar of a mansion full of lights and treasures and children. The rain had ceased, though mist still hid the peak, and shreds of cloud drifted through the high forest. Dulce was not a tireless walker like Silence, who would have spent his life wandering in the forests of Gaunt Mountain if he could. But he had been born in Rhea Albi and knew the roads and ways around it as part of himself. He took the shortcut at Rissy's well and came out before midday on Semmery's high pasture, a level step on the mountainside. A mile below it, all sunlit now, the farm building stood in the lee of a hill, across which a flock of sheep moved like a cloud shadow. Gaunt Port and its bay were hidden under the steep, knotted hills that stood above the city. Dulce wandered about a bit before he found what he took to be the dark pond. It was small, half mud and reeds, with one vague, boggy path to the water, no track on that but goat hooves. The water was dark, though it lay out under the bright sky and far above the peat soils. Dulce followed the goat tracks, growling when his foot slipped in the mud, and he wrenched his ankle to keep from falling. At the brink of the water, he stood still. He stooped to rub his ankle. He listened. It was absolutely silent. No wind, no bird call, no distant lowing or bleating or call of voice, as if all the island had gone still, not a fly buzzed. He looked at the dark water. It reflected nothing. Reluctant, he stepped forward barefoot and bare-legged. He had rolled up his cloak into his pack an hour ago when the sun came out. Reeds brushed his legs. The mud was soft and sucking under his feet, full of tangling reed roots. He made no noise as he moved slowly out into the pool, and the circles of ripples from his movement were slight and small. It was shallow for a long way. Then his cautious foot felt no bottom, and he paused. The water shivered. He felt it first on his thighs, a lapping like the tickling touch of fur. Then he saw it, the trembling of the surface all over the pond. Not the round ripples he made, which had already died away, but a ruffling, a roughening, a shudder, again and again. Where? He whispered, and then said the word aloud, in the language all things understand that have no other language. There was the silence. Then a fish leapt from the black, shaking water, a white-gray fish, the length of his hand. And as it leapt, it cried out in a small, clear voice in that same language, Yaved! The old wizard stood there. He recollected all he knew of the names of Gaunt. And after a while, he saw where Yaved was. It was the place where the ridges parted, just inland from Gauntport, the hinge of the headlands above the city, the place of the fault. An earthquake centered there could shake the city down, bring avalanche and tidal wave, close the cliffs of the bay together like hands clapping. Dulce shivered, shuddered all over like the water of the pool. He turned and made for the shore, hasty, careless where he set his foot, not caring if he broke the silence by splashing and breathing hard. He slogged back up the path through the reeds till he reached dry ground and coarse grass, and heard the buzz of midges and crickets. He sat down then on the ground, hard, for his legs were shaking. It won't do, he said, talking to himself in Hardik. And then he said, I can't do it. And then he said, I can't do it by myself. He was so distraught that when he made up his mind to call silence, he couldn't think of the opening of the spell, which he had known for 60 years. Then, when he thought he had it, he began to speak a summoning instead, and the spell had begun to work before he realized what he was doing and stopped and undid it word by word. He pulled up some grass and rubbed the slimy mud on his feet and legs. It wasn't dry yet and only smeared about on his skin. I hate mud, whispered. Then he snapped his jaws and stopped trying to clean his legs. Dirt. Dirt, he said, gently patting the ground he sat on. Then, very slow, very careful, he began to speak the spell of calling. In a busy street leading down to the busy wharves of Gauntport, the wizard Ogion stopped short. The ship's captain beside him walked on several steps and turned to see Ogion talking to the air. But I will come, master, he said. And then, after a pause, how soon? And after a longer pause, he told the air something in a language the ship's captain did not understand, and made a gesture that darkened the air about him for an instant. Captain, he said, I'm sorry, I must wait to spell your sails. An earthquake is near. I must warn the city. Do you tell them down there, every ship that can sail, make for the open sea, clear out, past the armed cliffs. Good luck to you. And he turned and ran back up the street, a tall, strong man with rough, graying hair, running now like a stag. Gauntport lies at the inner end of a long, narrow bay between steep shores. Its entrance from the sea is between two great headlands, the gates of the port, the armed cliff, not 100 feet apart. They are safe from sea pirates in Gauntport, but their safety is their danger. The long bay follows a fault in the earth, and jaws that have opened may shut. When he had done what he could to warn the city and seen all the gate guards and port guards doing what they could to keep the few roads out from becoming choked and murderous with panicky people, Ogion shut himself into a room in the signal tower of the port, locked the door, for everybody wanted him at once, and sent ascending to the dark pond in Semmery's cow pasture up on the mountain. His old master was sitting in the grass near the pond eating an apple. Bits of eggshell flecked the ground near his legs, which were caked with drying mud. When he looked up and saw Ogion's sending, he smiled a wide, sweet smile. But he looked old. He had never looked so old. Ogion had not seen him for over a year, having been busy. He was always busy in Gauntport, doing the business of the lords and people. Never a chance to walk in the forests on the mountainside, or come sit with Enheman in the little house at Rey Albi and listen and be still. Enheman was an old man, near 80 now, and he was frightened. He smiled with joy to see Ogion, but he was frightened. I think what we have to do, he said without preamble, is try to hold the fault from slipping much, you at the gates and me at the inner end in the mountain. Working together, you know, we might be able to. I can feel it building up, can you? Ogyan shook his head. He let his sending sit down in the grass near Enhemon, though it did not bend the stems of the grass where it stepped or sat. I've done nothing but set the city in a panic, he said, and send the ships out of the bay. What is it you feel? How do you feel it? They were technical questions, mage to mage. Enhemon hesitated before answering. I learned from Ard, he said, and paused again. He had never told Ogyan anything about his first teacher, a sorcerer of no fame, even in Gaunt, and perhaps of ill fame. There was some mystery or shame connected with Ard. Though he was talkative for a wizard, Enhemon was silent as a stone about some things. Ogyan, who respected silence, had never asked him about his teacher. It's not rogue magic, the old man said. His voice was dry, a little forced. Nothing against the balance, though, nothing sticky. That had always been his word for evil doings, spells for gain, curses, black magic, sticky stuff. After a while, searching for words, he went on, dirt, rocks, it's a dirty magic. Old, very old as Gaunt Island. The old powers, Ogyan murmured. Enhemon nodded. Will it control the earth itself? More a matter of getting in with it, I think. Enhemon was burying the core of his apple and the larger bits of eggshell under loose dirt, patting it over them neatly. Of course, I know the words, but I'll have to learn what to do as I go. That's the trouble with the big spells, isn't it? You learn what you're doing while you do it. No chance to practice. Oh, there. You feel that? Ogyan shook his head. Training, Enhemon said, his eyes in-looking, his hand still absently, gently patting the dirt as one might pat a scared cow. Quite soon now, I think. Can you hold the gates open, my dear? Tell me what you'll be doing. But Enhemon was shaking his head. No, he said, no time. Not your kind of thing. He was more and more distracted by whatever it was he sensed in the earth or air, and through him Ogyan felt that gathering intolerable tension. But after a while he relaxed a little and even smiled. Very old stuff, he said. I wish now I'd thought about it more, passed it on to you. But it seemed a bit crude, heavy-handed. She didn't say where she'd learned it. Here, of course. There are different kinds of knowledge, after all. She? Ard, my teacher. Enhemon looked up, his face unreadable, its expression possibly sly. You didn't know that? No, I suppose I never mentioned it. But it doesn't make much difference, after all. Since we none of us have any sex, us wizards, do we? What matters is whose house we live in. It seems we may have left out a good deal worth knowing. This kind of thing. There. There again. His sudden tension and immobility, the strained face and inward look, were like those of a woman in labor when her womb contracts. That was Ogyan's thought, even as he said, what did you mean in the mountain? The spasm passed, and Enhemon answered, inside the mountain, there at Yavet. He pointed to the knotted hills below them. I'll go in, try to keep things from sliding around. Eh? I'll find out how when I'm doing it, no doubt. I think you should be getting back to yourself. Things are tightening up. He stopped again, looking as if he were in intense pain, hunched and clenched. He struggled to stand up. Unthinking, Ogyan held out his hand to help him. No use, said the old wizard, grinning. You're only wind and sunlight. Now, I'm going to be dirt and stone. You'd best go on. Farewell, Aihal. Keep the mouth open for once, eh? Ogyan, obedient, bringing himself back to himself in the stuffy, tapestried room in Gaunt Port, didn't understand the old man's joke until he turned to the window and saw the armed cliff down at the end of the long bay, the jaws ready to snap shut. "I will," he said, and set to it. "What I have to do, you see," the old wizard said, still talking to Silence because it was a comfort to talk to him, even if he was no longer there, "is get into the mountain right inside, but not the way a sorcerer prospector does, not just slipping about between things and looking and tasting. Deeper, all the way in. Not the veins, but the bone. So." And standing there alone in the high pasture, in the noon light, and Haman opened his arms wide in the gesture of invocation that opens all the greater spells. And he spoke. Nothing happened as he said the words Ard had taught him, his old witch teacher with her bitter mouth and her long, lean arms. The words spoken awry then, spoken truly now. Nothing happened. And he had time to regret the sunlight and the sea wind, and to doubt the spell, and to doubt himself, before the earth rose up around him dry, warm, and dark. In there he knew he should hurry, that the bones of the earth ached to move, and that he must become them to guide them. But he could not hurry. There was on him the bewilderment of any transformation. He had, in his day, been fox and bull and dragonfly, and knew what it was to change being. But this was different, this slow enlargement. "I am vastening," he thought. He reached out towards Yaved, towards the ache, the suffering. As he came closer to it, he felt a great strength flow into him from the west, as if Silence had taken him by the hand after all. Through that link he could send his own strength, the mountain's strength, to help. "I didn't tell him I wasn't coming back," he thought, his last words in Hardik, his last grief, for he was in the bones of the mountain now. He knew the arteries of fire and the beat of the great heart. He knew what to do. It was in no tongue of man that he said, "Be quiet. Be easy, there now, there. Hold fast, so there. We can be easy." And he was easy. He was still. He held fast, rock in rock, and earth, in the fiery dark of the mountain. It was their mage, Ogion, whom the people saw stand alone on the roof of the signal tower on the wharf, when the streets ran up and down in waves, the cobbles bursting out of them, and walls of clay brick puffed into dust, and the armed cliffs leaned together, groaning. It was Ogion they saw, his hands held out before him, straining, parting, and the cliffs parted with them and stood straight, unmoved. The city shuddered and stood still. It was Ogion who stopped the earthquake. They saw it. They said it. "My teacher was with me, and his teacher with him," Ogion said when they praised him. "I could hold the gate open because he held the mountain still." They praised his modesty and didn't listen to him. Listening is a rare gift, and men will have their heroes. When the city was in order again, and the ships had all come back, and the walls were being rebuilt, Ogion escaped from praise and went up into the hills above Gauntport. He found the queer little valley called Trimmer's Dell, the true name of which, in the language of the making, was Yaved, as Ogion's true name was Aiha. He walked about there all one day, as if seeking something. In the evening, he lay down on the ground and talked to it. "You should have told me. I could have said goodbye," he said. He wept once, and his tears fell onto the dry dirt among the grass stems, and made little spots of mud, little sticky spots. He slept there, on the ground. At sunrise he got up and walked by the high road over to Ray Albi. He did not go into the village, but passed it, to the two-roomed house that stood alone to the north at the beginning of the overfill. The door of the house stood open. The last beans had got big and coarse on the vines. The cabbages were thriving. Three hens came clucking and pecking around the dusty dooryard, a red, a brown, a white. A gray hen was sitting her clutch in the henhouse. There were no chicks, and no sign of the cock, the king, and Hemon had called him. The king is dead, Ogion thought. Maybe a chick is hatching even now to take his place. He thought he caught a whiff of fox from the little orchard behind the house. He swept out the dust and leaves that had blown in the open door across the polished wood floor, and set Enhemon's mattress and blanket in the sun to air. I'll stay here a while, he thought. It's a good place. After a while, he thought, I might keep some goats.
On the High Marsh. The island of Semel lies north and west across the Pelnish Sea from Havnor, south and west of the Enlades. Though it is one of the great isles of the Earth Sea archipelago, there aren't many stories from Semel. Enlad has its glorious history and Havnor its wealth, and Palm its ill repute. But Semel has only cattle and sheep, forests and little towns, and the great silent volcano called Andandan standing over all. South of Andandan lies a land where the ashes fell 100 feet deep when last the volcano spoke. Rivers and streams cut their way seaward through that high plain, winding and pooling, spreading and wandering, making a marsh of it, a big, desolate waterland with a far horizon, few trees, not many people. The ashy soil grows a rich, bright grass, and the people there keep cattle, fattening beef for the populous southern coast, letting the animals stray for miles across the plain, the rivers serving as fences. As mountains will, Andandan makes the weather. It gathers clouds around it. The summer is short, the winter long, out on the high marsh. In the early darkness of a winter day, a traveler stood at the wind-swept crossing of two paths, neither very promising, mere cattle tracks among the reeds, and looked for some sign of the way he should take. As he came down the last slope of the mountain, he had seen houses here and there out in the marshlands, a village not far away. He had thought he was on the way to the village, but had taken a wrong turning somewhere. Tall reeds rose up close beside the paths, so that if a light shone anywhere, he could not see it. Water chuckled softly somewhere near his feet. He had used up his shoes walking round Andandan on the cruel roads of black lava. The soles were worn right through, and his feet ached with the icy damp of the marsh paths. It grew darker quickly. A haze was coming up from the south, blotting out the sky. Only above the huge, dim bulk of the mountain did stars burn clearly. Wind whistled in the reeds, soft, dismal. The traveler stood at the crossway and whistled back at the reeds. Something moved on one of the tracks, something big, dark, in the darkness. Are you there, my dear? Said the traveler. He spoke in the old speech, the language of the making. Come along, then, Ula, he said, and the heifer came a step or two towards him, towards her name, while he walked to meet her. He made out the big head more by touch than sight, stroking the silken dip between her eyes, scratching her forehead at the roots of the nubbin horns. Beautiful, you are beautiful, he told her, breathing her grassy breath, leaning against her large warmth. Will you lead me, dear Ula? Will you lead me where I need to go? He was fortunate in having met a milch cow, not one of the roaming cattle who would only have led him deeper into the marshes. His Ula was given to jumping fences, but after she had wandered a while, she would begin to have fond thoughts of the cow barn and the mother from whom she still stole a mouthful of milk sometimes. And now she willingly took the traveler home. She walked, slow but purposeful, down one of the tracks, and he went with her, a hand on her hip when the way was wide enough. When she waded a knee-deep stream, he held onto her tail, She scrambled up the low, muddy bank and flicked her tail loose, but she waited for him to scramble even more awkwardly after her. Then she plodded gently on. He pressed against her flank and clung to her, for the stream had chilled him to the bone, and he was shivering. Said his guide softly, and he saw the dim, small square of yellow light just a little to his left. Thank you, he said, opening the gate for the heifer, who went to greet her mother while he stumbled across the dark house yard to the door. It would be Barry at the door, though why he knocked, she didn't know. Come in, you fool, she said, and he knocked again, and she put down her mending and went to the door. Can you be drunk already, she said, and then saw him. The first thing she thought was a king, a lord, Marion of the songs, tall, straight, beautiful. The next thing she thought was a beggar, a lost man in dirty clothes, hugging himself with shivering arms. He said, I lost my way. Have I come to the village? His voice was hoarse and harsh, a beggar's voice, but not a beggar's accent. It's a half mile on, said Gift. Is there an inn? Not till you'd come to Oraby, a 10-12 miles on south. She considered only briefly. If you need a room for the night, I have one. Or San might, if you're going to the village. I'll stay here, if I may, he said in that princely way, with his teeth chattering, holding on to the door jamb to keep on his feet. Take your shoes off, she said. They're soaking. Come in, then. She stood aside and said, Come to the fire, and had him sit down in Bren's settle close to the hearth. Stir the fire up a bit, she said. We have a bit of soup. It's still hot. Thank you, mistress, he muttered, crouching at the fire. She brought him a bowl of broth. He drank from it eagerly, yet warily, as if long unaccustomed to hot soup. You came over the mountain? He nodded. Whatever for? To come here, he said. He was beginning to tremble less. His bare feet were a sad sight, bruised, swollen, sodden. She wanted to tell him to put them right to the fire's warmth, but didn't like to presume. Whatever he wasn't a beggar by choice. Not many come here to the high marsh, she said. Peddlers and such, but not in winter. He finished his soup and she took the bowl. She sat down in her place, the stool by the oil lamp to the right of the hearth, and took up her mending. Get warm through and then I'll show you to your bed, she said. There's no fire in that room. Did you meet weather up on the mountain? They say there's been snow. Some flurries, he said. She got a good look at him now in the light of lamp and fire. He was 40 or so. Thin, not as tall as she had thought. It was a fine face, but there was something wrong, something amiss. He looks ruined, she thought, a ruined man. Why would you come to the marsh? She asked. She had a right to ask, having taken him in, yet she felt a discomfort in pressing the question. I was told there's a murrain among the cattle here. Now that he wasn't all locked up with cold, his voice was beautiful. He talked like the tale-tellers when they spoke the parts of the heroes and the dragon lords. Maybe he was a teller or a singer. But no, the murrain, he had said. There is. I may be able to help the beasts. You're a curer? He nodded. Then you will be more than welcome. The plague is terrible among the cattle, and getting worse. He said nothing. She could see the warmth coming into him, untying him. Put your feet up to the fire, she said abruptly. I have some old shoes of my husband's. It cost her something to say that. Yet when she had said it, she felt released. Untied, too. What was she keeping Bren's shoes for, anyhow? They were too small for Barry and too big for her. She'd given away his clothes, but kept the shoes. She didn't know what for. For this fellow, it would seem. Things came round if you could wait for them, she thought. I'll set him out for you, she said. Yours are perished. He glanced at her. His dark eyes were large, deep, opaque, like a horse's eyes, unreadable. He's dead, she said. 2 years. The marsh fever. You have to watch out for that here. The water. I live with my brother. He's in the village, at the tavern. We keep a dairy. I make cheese. Our herd's been all right, and she made the sign to avert evil. I keep 'em close in. Out on the ranges, the moraine's very bad. Maybe the cold weather'll put an end to it. More likely to kill the beasts that sicken with it, the man said. He sounded a bit sleepy. I'm called Gift, she said. My brother's Barry. Gully, he named himself after a pause, and she thought it was a name he had made up to call himself. It did not fit him. Nothing about him fit together, made a whole. Yet she felt no distrust of him. She was easy with him. He meant no harm to her. She thought there was kindness in him, the way he spoke of the animals. He would have a way with them, she thought. He was like an animal himself, a silent, damaged creature that needed protection but could not ask for it. Come, she said, before you fall asleep there. And he followed her obediently to Barry's room, which wasn't much more than a cupboard built onto the corner of the house. Her room was behind the chimney. Barry would come in drunk in a while, and she'd put down the pallet in the chimney corner for him. Let the traveler have a good bed for a night. Maybe he'd leave a copper or two with her when he went on. There was a terrible shortage of coppers in her household these days.